A thrilling pulse beat high in me. My step was light on deck in the crisp air. I felt that there could be no turning back, and that I was engaging in an adventure the meaning of which I thoroughly understood. I had taken little advice from anyone, for I had a right to my own opinions in matters pertaining to the sea.
Welcome to Meridians.
Welcome back to Meridians. I am Charlie Noble, and I'm really excited about this episode. Holy crap, this guy, this Joshua Slocum guy, he exceeded all expectations I ever had of a person I was reading about. This trip is one hell of a trip, and I'm still just kind of just in awe of this guy's adventurous life. So, without further ado, let me just review what we were talking about in the previous episode. So in the previous episode, I spoke about Joshua Slocum and his early life. So he lived a full, exciting life before he ever made this famous voyage around the world alone. So when he started off on this voyage, you know, it's safe to admit he knew what he was doing. He had spent decades at sea at that point that he left. He knew all about sailing. And so, you know, that's where that quote that he said, he's basically saying that I'm kind of the master now. It's some kind of sort of a Mr. Miyagi kind of a quote there. He's been a student of the sea all of his life, and now it's time for him to go prove that he is a master of the sea. Okay, so in other words, he knew what he was doing. No one could stop him. I'll just go from here because it'll become apparent. So Slocum's first stop on his voyage was fairly soon. It was Gloucester, Massachusetts. And he told people of his voyage, and, you know, everybody got him excited. They were all supportive. You know, it was probably a great first pit stop. And, you know, he did some work on his ship. He applied some copper plating, and he was even given a fisherman's life as a present. He purchased a little half dory, this little tub, and that'll come up later because the idea with this little dory is that it'd be a raft or also to be used as a tub for bathing. And that's the key thing to remember about Slocum. And this is the running theme throughout this episode is I think of MacGyver, but just think of somebody, he's really resourceful. That was apparent in the first episode I did about him. He was shipwrecked more than one occasion, and he's just able to get by. He has this kind of a make-do attitude is what he called it. And so after a few weeks of preparing and gathering supplies in Massachusetts, he actually made a couple stops off the ports of Massachusetts to just gather various supplies. And then he sets out for the Atlantic. And within just a few weeks, I mean, that's quite a while to be by yourself and for the loneliness to finally set in after a few weeks, he would just have to keep himself occupied, though, with work. And focusing on work was a big thing. The other thing he would do would sing to himself to keep himself company. You know, he seemed to understand that this might be the weakest part of this trip is being able to cope with the loneliness. So he was going to have to learn pretty quickly how to deal with it. And it seems like he deals with it in various ways here. But so then he makes a stop in the Azores and he's offered free fruit by the natives. You know, it sounds like it was nice weather. He's grateful for their kindness. And, you know, he's been at sea for 18 days now and he's been doing about 150 miles per day. It's, you know, the sun is shining. It's beautiful. Besides some fog he'd had just a few weeks earlier, the trip, it was going well until it wasn't. So he ran into a gale and some large waves, but then to make matters worse, he became delirious. And it was either from bad plums or bad cheese that he had eaten. It made him delirious. And, you know, he's in these heavy, his heavy chop and delirium. And he begins to think, instead of waves crashing over the side of the boat, he sees boats crashing into the boat. And he apparently even shouted out and said, "You'll smash your boats, but you can't hurt the spray. She is strong." And that boat that he's referring to is the boat he's on, the Spray, which I should remind people is the boat he built in Massachusetts by himself. He customized this boat for this purpose. It is a purpose-built boat for a single person to use. And so he knows this boat inside and out, and he put all of his experience into designing it. So after 29 days into the voyage, he finally sees Spain. So it's only a month has passed, and he's basically gone from North America to Europe. So he passes through the Strait of Gibraltar, and he makes a stop at Gibraltar, and he gets some help from this British admiral. He helps Slocum mend his sails and keeps him fed. So then Slocum spends a few weeks there reading and resting and preparing for the rest of his journey. So then on August 25th, he leaves Gibraltar. Now, he was actually planning on traveling through the Mediterranean and passing through the Suez Canal, but he was made aware, probably while he was on Gibraltar, that there was pirates in the southern Mediterranean, and it'd be pretty dangerous to go that way. So instead of an eastern voyage around the world, he would head southwest to Brazil and start a western voyage around the world. I mean, this was no small course correction, right? Most of the nearly 3,500 miles that he'd already traveled was in the opposite direction. In the opposite direction to his path that he was on. So he's basically given himself an extra 3,500 miles, sort of, to cross now. And then he even encountered pirates as he was passing out of Gibraltar, which is ironic because that's what he was trying to avoid. But fortunately for him, there wasn't much of an incident. Their mast tore in some heavy seas, and you know, he lost them. So he just, this is a good, probably the first example of his perseverance, just winning through the day. And it's just kind of amazing, this guy. I mean, this probably barely even scratched the surface on him being bothered by this. So 40 days later, then, he would be anchored in Pernambuco Harbor in Brazil. He actually had a wealthy friend there that helped him with provisions, and so then he'd prepare for the rest of his trip. So then he would sail down the coast. So we're talking about the east coast of South America. He's sailing really close to the shore because the current was so strong flowing north. And, you know, it's obviously close to the shore. It's dangerous because you can run aground, which is exactly what he did. He ran his ship aground, and he had to use that little half dory tub, and he got ashore. And this is a weird detail about Joshua Slocum. I can't hardly believe this, but it's true. He can't swim. Yeah, the man has dedicated his life to the ocean, but he can't swim? I don't understand it. I probably never will, but Nova Scotia has plenty of beaches and lakes and waterways when he was growing up that you think he would have taken part in, you know, like he sailed when he was a little boy, like nobody taught him to swim. It's insane. So, but anyway, Slocum is pretty discouraged. You know, his boat is fairly damaged and he just knows he's got difficult days ahead of him. And it seems like that's where you could look at him, if you were standing there watching him, you go, oh man, he's given up. But it seems more like he is, in his mind, he's like, oh, this is going to be difficult to finish. It's going to be tough days ahead. Not, it's, the defeat wasn't even a question. You know, he was never going to quit. So he dusts himself off, he gets some local help, and he gets his boat to a dock in Montevideo, Uruguay, which had to be difficult at all, you know, just to find somebody and get help. You know, you're in foreign country. I mean, he's a well-traveled guy, and he had been to Uruguay before, so certainly he had some friends in the area. So then what he did was he shortened the spray's mast height, and he also shortened the bowsprit, which is that's that large pole you see pointing out of the front of a sailboat. It's got the triangular sail attached to it. So he likely did this to make his boat more stable in rough conditions. You know, less sail, it isn't going to wobble as round much in wild winds. But also clearance for bridges is the other reason people would lower their mast, but it's probably mostly just for stability. And it would certainly have an impact on the ship's performance, but he probably thought the risk of wrecking is worse than the boat being a little bit slower. So in January 1896, he leaves Buenos Aires, heading south down the coast of South America. So now he's got to round the Cape Horn, and down there, the seas can be very scary. There's many stories of shipwrecks and tragedies that have happened there, and Slocum is very aware of this. So sometime around Patagonia, his storm came, and in the midst of this storm, he sees this giant wave approaching, just like something out of Moby Dick or some old sailing movie, The Perfect Storm or something. But he quickly took down his sail and he climbed up into the rigging, and then he held tight to the mast and sails in the rigging, and below him, all he saw was water. And then he'd see his boat come popping out of the water, and then it would only to be crashed and covered with water again. And this happened for a while. So I mean, just imagine being completely isolated. It's gloomy. You're alone on the sea on your little sailboat trying to survive a storm where the waves are many times bigger than your own boat, and just holding tight to the mast while the boat is just riding on and through waves. He actually admitted he was terrified in those moments, but his experience and knowledge just kind of guided him through it. He and his boat survived the storm, and from here he was really reassured in the confidence he had in his vessel. I mean, he made it through something pretty horrible. I don't know, all I could think of was Lieutenant Dan when he fights the storm in the middle of Forrest Gump. And he comes out victorious, and it's like a beautiful day the next day. That's what I'm picturing for Slocum. So he does make a short little stop in Patagonia. Well, he thinks it's going to be short. And this is by about March 3rd, then he's heading out from Patagonia into the open Pacific. And he's not given much of any reprieve from the rough storms. He encounters rough seas and difficult conditions, and here's a quote from him. He says, Hail and sleet in the fierce squalls cut my flesh till the blood trickled over my face. But what of that? In other words, yeah, it sucks, but who cares? Clearly, he was purely driven and determined, and he wasn't going to back down at all, no matter what the world threw at him. So, which is funny because now he's got such strong winds in the Pacific blowing him back east that he just couldn't overcome it by tacking, apparently, or anything like that. He was forced back to shore, and he would make several attempts to launch into the Pacific. Six, in fact. And then in between those attempts, he's anchored and he's having to fight off natives who want to board his ship and take his ship and kill him, or, you know, some of them he's having dealings with, some are friends. But this one whole little month could be considered an entire adventure alone, but it's basically a footnote in his full journey. So finally, favorable winds in the first weeks of April. So it's now April 26th, and he's made it to Juan Fernandez Island, and he moors up at the port there. So now he's been at sea roughly a year, and he's mostly just gone down. I mean, he's gone across the Atlantic twice, and he's gone down and around South America, and then up. It's about a third of the way up the coast of South America to Juan Fernandez Island. So from there, he starts making great progress in the Pacific. He makes it to the island of Nacavia, but he just sails right past it. And if you look up this island, it's pretty much right in the middle of the South Pacific. He's got to be about as far from his culture and populated civilization as anyone can get. So then, 29 days later, on July 16th, he makes it to Apia on the island of Samoa. Apia. And visiting the Samoans, he's kind of reflects on society. And he apparently is realizing that the farther he gets away from society, the happier he seems to be. Back home, everyone is in the fervor of this capitalist mindset, and these places he's visiting, they couldn't have been more different. They were simply living, and he just admired them for that. And also, they're just super friendly and nice. He spends about a month in Samoa before he sets off. And after 43 days of more storms and more gales, he arrives in Sydney, Australia. Then from there, he heads down the coast of Australia and makes his way to Melbourne and heads into port. And Melbourne's port charged a tonnage fee, and he wasn't able to get out of paying it, apparently. You know, he might have tried to, you know, charm them and say, I'm going around the world, you know, don't you think you could just let me get by? And they, you know, nah, you'll pay the fee like everybody else, they said. So the way he was able to get by, he made a bit of a spectacle out of his boat, and he let people come aboard and look at it for a small fee. I suppose he told them he's on this voyage around the world, and, you know, he even, like, caught a shark and charged people to look at the shark. But this is exactly Slocum doing what he'd do. He knew how to make do, and with whatever he could. It's just the way it was. So he made his way out of Melbourne, and then he headed south to Tasmania. And this makes it crystal clear, if it wasn't already, that this trip wasn't about going around the world as fast as one could. You know, this was really more of a world tour, a solo world tour, the trip of a lifetime, one of the greatest trips of all time, probably. Few could say they've done what he's done even up until this point. He actually bounces around Australia for several months. You know, he hits Tasmania and he has all these encounters, and, you know, there's all kinds of things. I think he was lecturing at one point. Like, he kind of settled there for a little bit, you know, it's kind of funny. But then he finally leaves Australia and he heads west and he makes his way to the Indian Ocean. He's making 130 miles per day, roughly, and by July 2nd, 1897, he makes it to Christmas Island. Then in July 17th, he lands at Keeling Island. So it's July 17th of the following. So now it's almost been, we're talking 2 years now. Yeah, he spent a lot of time crossing the Pacific and bouncing around Australia. So yeah, we're now over 2 years into this voyage. So now, being the world traveler that Slocum was, he lands on this Keeling Island, and he must be a great communicator, because all these encounters he has, most of them are really friendly. And he seems to be able to embed himself and endear himself to wherever he goes into port. It's like some kind of superpower. Like, everywhere he went, he got some kind of help. And he learned about the people. He took an active interest in their culture, and they were interested in him as well. He was friendly, and it seems like everybody took an interest in what he was doing, but most, it had to have something to do with his attitude. So yeah, it's, I mean, he just had so many stops that seem to go on like this, where he's got friends and he's got all kinds of, he makes friends so easily, it seems. So he makes it to the Cape of Good Hope off the southern coast of Africa on Christmas Day, 1897. He then stops at Cape Town and spends several months there. You know, he's on that world tour. You know, he's seeing the sights. You could almost picture him as like a some kind of world traveler with the little camera and the fun little hat, you know. And he even meets the president of South Africa, who apparently insisted to Slocum that the world is flat, which had to be somewhat amusing to Slocum, particularly since he is in the middle of a voyage around the world. And he's pretty much done 80% of it at this point too. So, but anyway, in March, he then leaves South Africa, March of 1888 now, because remember, he spent 3 months in Africa. So we're talking March of 1888. And by April 16th, he makes it to St. Helena. And this was the final island Napoleon had been exiled and eventually passed away on. And this was only 80 years later that he's visiting the island. So he was Slocum being Slocum. He was a super tourist. He visited with the governor. He gave lectures about his travels. And of course, he visited the home of Napoleon. And, you know, just, I mean, he's doing what any typical person would do, but he's just he's a model traveler, it seems like. So he seems like the patron saint of traveling. Apparently, he's the patron saint of small sailing ships, by the way. But by May of 1898, he's long left St. Helena, and he's continued to go west. And so in May of 1898, he crosses the point he'd been at in October of 1895, which is a big deal because it means he's gone all the way around the world. He said, "I felt a contentment in knowing that the spray had encircled the globe, and even as an adventure alone, I was in no way discouraged as to its utility, and said to myself, let what will happen, the voyage is now on record." So in other words, he's like, all right, I did it. It's done. Now, whatever I do, it's whatever the voyage may be. It's kind of like telling himself, hey, you can relax now. You did it. You went all the way around the world. Now it's time to have some fun, right? So he's saying, just enjoy yourself. So he lets the current carry him up the coast of Brazil. And that's that same current that he had ran aground trying to fight against by going close to shore the 3 years earlier. So by May 22nd, he arrives in Granada. But from there, he makes his way north. And on June 27th, 1898, he cast anchor in Newport Harbor in Rhode Island, which is straight south of Boston. And so this was his, what he considered the end of his trip. He traveled 46,000 miles around the world during a time of 3 years and 2 months. He said that after the voyage, he felt 10 years younger than the day that he first felled a tree to build the spray. Slocum had used simple tools on his ship and had navigated without the use of a chronometer, which was a more modern sailing device for the time. Instead, he just used traditional methods such as dead reckoning and celestial navigation, which had been employed for hundreds of years. He had proven his mastery at sea as a sailor and as a maritime legend. When Slocum published his book, Sailing Alone Around the World, in 1900, it was an immediate success. Though it sold really well, it wasn't the most financially successful book for Slocum, but he was able to settle down and buy a small farm in West Tisbury, Massachusetts, with his earnings from it. So Slocum would make a voyage years later. He probably made other small voyages, but he'd make one final voyage. It would be his last. He left Martha's Vineyard on November 14th, 1909, aboard the Spray, and he had intended to explore South America's Orinoco and Amazon rivers, and he apparently was never seen or heard from again after his departure. So no one actually knows what happened to him. His boat nor he was never found. Personally, I have to ask you this. Does it do anyone harm to imagine that Slocum simply left and kept sailing? He was 64 years old when he last left Massachusetts. As ridiculous as an idea as it probably is, I'll reserve my right to believe that he may have sailed on for years, just alone, having said goodbye to his life in New England and resigned himself to sailing out the rest of his days. After Slocum's legendary voyage, after he'd completed it, he said this about his trip. One does not need to be a rich man to undertake such a voyage, and one doesn't need a sponsor. To succeed, however, in anything at all, one should go understandingly about his work and be prepared for every emergency. I see, as I look back over my own small achievement, a kit of not too elaborate carpenter's tools, a tin clock, and some carpet tacks. But above all, to be taken into account were some years of schooling, where I studied with diligence Neptune's laws, and these laws I tried to obey when I sailed overseas. It was worth the while. And thank you so much for listening to this episode of Meridians. We'll be back next week, and we'll just surprise you with what that topic will be. It'll be related to something in Slocum's journey.